On my way back, I tried to list the oddities which had preceded and then surrounded my return to Sarah Laughs. The repeating dreams, the sunflowers, the radio station sticker, the weeping in the night. I supposed that my encounter with Maddie and Kyra, plus the follow-up phone call from Mr. Pixel Easel, also qualified as passing strange, but not in the same way as a child you heard sobbing in the night. And what about the fact that we had been in Derry instead of on Dark Score when Joanna died? Did that qualify for the list? I didn't know. I couldn't even remember why that was. In the fall and winter of 1993, I'd been writing short stories and fiddling with a screenplay for The Red Shirt Man. In February of 94, I got going on All the Way from the Top, and that absorbed most of my attention. Besides, deciding to go west to the TR, west to Sarah, that was Joe's job, I told the day, and as soon as I heard the words, I understood how true they were. We'd both loved the old girl, but saying, "Hey, Irish, let's get our asses over to the TR for a few days," had been Joe's job. She might say at any time, except in the year before her death, she hadn't said it once. And I had never thought to say it for her, had somehow forgotten all about Sarah Laughs, it seemed, even when summer came around. Was it possible to be that absorbed in a writing project? It didn't seem likely. But what other explanation was there? Something was very wrong with this picture, but I didn't know what it was. Not from nothing. That made me think of Sarah Tidwell and the lyrics to one of her songs. She had never been recorded, but I owned the Blind Melon Jefferson version of this particular tune. One verse went, "It ain't nothing but a barn dance, sugar. It ain't nothing but a round and round. Let me kiss you on your sweet lips, sugar. You the good thing that I found." I loved that song, and had always wondered how it would have sounded coming out of a woman's mouth instead of from that whiskey-voiced old troubadour, out of Sarah Tidwell's mouth. I bet she sang sweet, and boy, I bet she could swing it. I had gotten back to my own place again. I looked around, saw no one in the immediate vicinity, although I could now hear the day's first ski boat burring away down water. Stripped to my underpants and swam out to the float. I didn't climb it, only lay beside it, holding onto the ladder with one hand and lazily kicking my feet. It was nice enough, but what was I going to do with the rest of the day? I decided to spend it cleaning my work area on the second floor. When that was done, maybe I'd go out and look around in Joe's studio, if I didn't lose my courage, that was. I swam back, kicking easily along, raising my head in and out of the water, which flowed along my body like cool silk. I felt like an otter. I was most of the way to the shore when I raised my dripping face and saw a woman standing on the street, watching me. She was as thin as the one I'd seen down at Warrington's. But this one was green. Green and pointing north along the path like a dryad in some old legend. I gasped, swallowed water, coughed it back out. I stood up in chest-deep water and wiped my streaming eyes. Then I laughed, albeit a little doubtfully. The woman was green because she was a birch growing a little to the north of where my set of railroad tie steps ended at the street. And even with my eyes clear of water, there was something creepy about how the leaves around the ivory streak with black trunk almost made a peering face. The air was perfectly still, and so the face was perfectly still as the face of the woman in the black shorts and bathing suit had been. But on a breezy day, it would seem to smile or frown, or perhaps to laugh. Behind it, there grew a sickly pine. One bare branch jutted off to the north. It was this I had mistaken for a skinny arm and bony, pointing hand. It wasn't the first time I'd spooked myself like that. I see things, that's all. Write enough stories, and every shadow on the floor looks like a footprint, every line in the dirt like a secret message. Which did not, of course, ease the task of deciding what was really peculiar at Sarah Laughs, and what was peculiar only because my mind was peculiar. I glanced around, saw I still had this part of the lake to myself, although not for much longer, the bee-buzz of the first powerboat had been joined by a second and third, and stripped off my soggy underpants. I wrung them out, put them on top of my shorts and T-shirt, and walked naked up the railroad tie steps with my clothes held against my chest. I pretended I was Bunter, bringing breakfast in the morning paper to Lord Peter Wimsey. By the time I got back inside the house, I was grinning like a fool. The second floor was stifling in spite of the open windows, and I saw why as soon as I got to the top of the stairs. Joe and I had shared space up here, she on the left, only a little room, really, just a cubby, which was all she needed with the studio north of the house, me on the right. At the far end of the hall was the grilled snout of the monster air conditioning unit we'd bought the year after we bought the lodge. Looking at it, I realized I had missed its characteristic hum without even being aware of it. There was a sign taped to it which said, "Mr. Noonan, broken. Blows hot air when you turn it on and sounds full of broken glass. Dean says the part it needs is promised from the Western Auto in Castle Rock. I'll believe it when I see it. Be Meserve." I grinned at that last. It was Mrs. M. right down to the ground, and then tried the switch. Machinery often responds favorably when it senses a penis-equipped human in the vicinity, Joe used to claim, but not this time. I listened to the air conditioner grind for 5 seconds or so, then snapped it off. "Damn thing, shit the bed," as TR folks like to say. And until it was fixed, I wouldn't even be doing crossword puzzles up here. I looked in my office just the same, as curious about what I might feel as about what I might find. The answer was next to nothing. There was the desk where I had finished the red shirt man, thus proving to myself that the first time wasn't a fluke. There was the photo of Richard Nixon, arms raised, flashing the double V for victory sign with the caption, "Would you buy a used car from this man?" running beneath. There was the rag rug Joe had hooked for me a winter or two before she had discovered the wonderful world of Afghans and pretty much gave hooking up. It wasn't quite the office of a stranger, but every item, most of all the weirdly empty surface of the desk, said that it was the workspace of an earlier generation Mike Noonan. Men's lives, I had read once, are usually defined by two primary forces, work and marriage. In my life, marriage was over, and the career on what appeared to be permanent hiatus. Given that, it didn't seem strange to me that now the space where I'd spent so many days, usually in a state of real happiness as I made up various imaginary lives, seemed to mean nothing. It was like looking at the office of an employee who had been fired, or who had died suddenly. I started to leave, then had an idea. The filing cabinet in the corner was crammed with papers. Bank statements, mostly 8 or 10 years out of date, correspondence, mostly never answered, a few story fragments, but I didn't find what I was looking for. I moved on to the closet, where the temperature had to be at least 110 degrees, and in a cardboard box which Mrs. M. had marked gadgets, I unearthed it. A Sanyo memo scriber Deborah Weinstock gave me at the conclusion of our work on the first of the Putnam's books. It could be set to turn itself on when you started to talk. It dropped into its pause mode when you stopped to think. I never asked Deborah if the thing just caught her eye and she thought, "Why, I'll bet any self-respecting popular novelist would enjoy owning one of these babies," or if it was something a little more specific, some sort of hint, perhaps. "Verbalize those little faxes from your subconscious while they're still fresh, Noonan?" I hadn't known then and didn't now. But I had it, a genuine pro-quality dictaphone, and there were at least a dozen cassette tapes in my car, home dubs I'd made to listen to while driving. I would insert one in the memo scriber tonight, slide the volume controller as high as it would go, and put the machine in its dictate mode. Then, if the noise I'd heard at least twice now repeated itself, I would have it on tape. I could play it for Bill Dean and ask him what he thought it was. What if I hear the sobbing child tonight and the machine never kicks on? Well, then, I'll know something else, I told the empty, sunlit office. I was standing there in the doorway with the dictaphone under my arm, looking at the empty desk and sweating like a pig, or at least suspected. Joe's nook across the hall made my office seem crowded and homey by comparison. Never overfull, it was now nothing but a square, room-shaped space. The rug was gone, her photos were gone, even the desk was gone. This looked like a do-it-yourself project which had been abandoned after 90% of the work had been done. Joe had been scrubbed out of it, scraped out of it, and I felt a moment's unreasonable anger at Brenda Meserve. I thought of what my mother usually said when I'd done something on my own initiative of which she disapproved. You took a little too much on yourself, didn't you? That was my feeling about Joe's little bit of office. That in emptying it to the walls this way, Mrs. Meserve had taken a little too much on herself. Maybe it wasn't Mrs. M. who cleaned it out, the UFO voice said. Maybe Joe did it herself. Ever think of that? Sport? That's stupid, I said. Why would she? I hardly think she had a premonition of her own death, considering she just bought... But I didn't want to say it. Not out loud. It seemed like a bad idea, somehow. I turned to leave the room, and a sudden sigh of cool air, amazing in that heat, rushed past the sides of my face. Not my body, just my face. It was the most extraordinary sensation, like hands patting briefly but gently at my cheeks and forehead. At the same time, there was a sighing in my ears, except that's not quite right. It was a susurrus that went past my ears, like a whispered message spoken in a hurry. I turned, expecting to see the curtains over the room's window in motion, but they hung perfectly straight. Joe, I said, and hearing her name made me shiver so violently that I almost dropped the dictaphone. Joe, was that you? Nothing. No phantom hands patting my skin, no motion from the curtains, which there certainly would have been if there had been an actual draft. All was quiet. There was only a tall man with a sweaty face and a tape recorder under his arm, standing in the doorway of a bare room. But that was when I first began to really believe that I wasn't alone in Sarah Laughs. So what? I asked myself. Even if it should be true, so what? Ghosts can't hurt anyone. That's what I thought then. When I visited Joe's studio after lunch, I felt quite a lot better about Brenda Meserve. She hadn't taken too much on herself after all. The few items I especially remembered from Joe's little office, the framed square of her first afghan, the green rag rug, her framed poster depicting the wildflowers of Maine, had been put out here, along with almost everything else I remembered. It was as if Mrs. M. had sent a message. I can't ease your pain or shorten your sadness, and I can't prevent the wounds that coming back here may reopen, but I can put all the stuff that may hurt you in one place, so you won't be stumbling over it unexpected or unprepared. I can do that much. Out here there were no bare walls. Out here the walls jostled with my wife's spirit and creativity. There were knitted things, some serious, many whimsical, batik squares, rag dolls popping out of what she called my baby collages, an abstract desert painting made from strips of yellow, black, and orange silk, her flower photographs, even, on top of her bookshelf, what appeared to be a sculpture in progress of Sarah Laughs herself. It was made out of toothpicks and lollipop sticks. In one corner was her little loom and a wooden cabinet with a sign reading, Joe's Knitting Stuff, No Trespassing, hung over the pull knob. In another was the banjo she had tried to learn and then given up on, saying it hurt her fingers too much. In a third was a kayak paddle and a pair of rollerblades with scuffed toes and little purple pom-poms on the tips of the laces. The thing which caught and held my eye was sitting on top of the old roll-top desk in the center of the room. During the many good summers, falls, and winter weekends we had spent here, that desktop would have been littered with spools of thread, skeins of yarn, pincushions, sketches, maybe a book about the Spanish Revolution or famous American dogs. Joanna could be aggravating, at least to me, because she imposed no real system or order upon what she did. She could also be daunting, even overwhelming at times. She was a brilliant scatterbrain, and her desk had always reflected that. But not now. It was possible to think that Mrs. M. had cleared the litter from the top of it and plunked down what was now there, but impossible to believe. Why would she? It made no sense. The object was covered with a gray plastic hood. I reached out to touch it, and my hand faltered an inch or two short as a memory of an old dream. "Give me that. It's my dust catcher," slipped across my mind, much as that queer draft had slipped across my face. And then it was gone, and I pulled the plastic cover off. Underneath it was my old green IBM Selectric, which I hadn't seen or thought of in years. I leaned closer, knowing that the typewriter ball would be Courier, my old favorite, even before I saw it. What in God's name was my old typewriter doing out here? Joanna painted, although not very well. She took photographs, very good ones indeed, and sometimes sold them. She knitted, she crocheted, she wove and dyed cloth. She could play 8 or 10 basic chords on the guitar. She could write, of course. Most English majors can, which is why they become English majors. Did she demonstrate any blazing degree of literary creativity? No. After a few experiments with poetry as an undergrad, she gave up that particular branch of the arts as a bad job. "You write for both of us, Mike," she had said once. "That's all yours. I'll just take a little taste of everything else." Given the quality of her poems as opposed to the quality of her silks, photographs, and knitted art, I thought that was probably wise. But here was my old IBM. Why? "Letters," I said. She found it down cellar or something and rescued it to write letters on. Except that wasn't Joe. She showed me most of her letters, often urging me to write little postscripts of my own, guilt-tripping me with that old saying about how the shoemaker's kids always go barefoot, and the writer's friends would never hear from him if it wasn't for Alexander Graham Bell, she was apt to add. I hadn't seen a typed personal letter from my wife in all the time we'd been married. If nothing else, she would have considered it shitty etiquette. She could type, producing mistake-free business letters slowly yet methodically, but she always used my desktop computer or her own PowerBook for these chores. "What were you up to, Hunt?" I asked, then began to investigate her desk drawers. Brenda Meserve had made an effort with these, but Joe's fundamental nature had defeated her. Surface order, spools of thread segregated by color, for instance, quickly gave way to Joe's old dear jumble. I found enough of her in those drawers to hurt my heart with 100 unexpected memories, but I found no paperwork which had been typed on my old IBM, with or without the Courier ball, not so much as a single page. When I was finished with my hunt, I leaned back in my chair, her chair, and looked at the little framed photo on her desk, one I couldn't remember ever seeing before. Joe had most likely printed it herself. The original might have come out of some local's attic, and then hand-tinted the result. The final product looked like a wanted poster colorized by Ted Turner. I picked it up and ran the ball of my thumb over the glass facing, bemused. Sarah Tidwell, the turn-of-the-century blues shouter whose last known port of call had been right here in TR-90. When she and her folks, some of them friends, most of them relatives, had left the TR, they had gone on to Castle Rock for a little while. Then it simply disappeared, like a cloud over the horizon or mist on a summer morning. She was smiling just a little in the picture, but the smile was hard to read. Her eyes were half closed. The string of her guitar, not a strap but a string, was visible over one shoulder. In the background, I could see a black man wearing a derby at a killer angle. One thing about musicians, they really know how to wear hats. and standing beside what appeared to be a washtub base. Joe had tinted Sarah's skin to a café au lait shade, maybe based on other pictures she'd seen. There are quite a few knocking around, mostly showing Sarah with her head thrown back and her hair hanging almost to her waist as she bellows out her famous carefree yell of a laugh. Although none would have been in color, not at the turn of the century. Sarah Tidwell hadn't just left her mark in old photographs, either. I recalled Dickie Brooks, owner of the all-purpose garage, once telling me that his father claimed to have won a teddy bear at the Castle County Fair's shooting pitch and to have given it to Sarah Tidwell. She had rewarded him, Dickie said, with a kiss. According to Dickie, the old man never forgot it, said it was the best kiss of his life, although I doubt if he said it in his wife's hearing. In this photo, she was only smiling. Sarah Tidwell, known as Sarah Laughs, never recorded, but her songs had lived just the same. One of them, Walk Me Baby, bears a remarkable resemblance to Walk This Way by Aerosmith. Today, the lady would be known as an African-American. In 1984, when Joanna and I bought the lodge and consequently got interested in her, she would have been known as a black. In her own time, she would have been called a negress or a darky or possibly an octoroon. And a nigger, of course. There would have been plenty of folks free with that one. And did I believe that she had kissed Dickie Brooks's father, a white man, in front of half of Castle County? No, I did not. Still, who could say for sure? No one. That was the entrancing thing about the past. "It ain't nothing but a barn dance, sugar," I sang, putting the picture back on the desk. "It ain't nothing but a round and round." I picked up the typewriter cover, then decided to leave it off. As I stood, my eyes went back to Sarah, standing there with her eyes closed and the string which served her as a guitar strap visible over one shoulder. Something in her face and smile had always struck me as familiar, and suddenly it came to me. She looked oddly like Robert Johnson, whose primitive licks hid behind the chords of almost every Led Zeppelin and Yardbird song ever recorded, who, according to the legend, had gone down to the crossroads and sold his soul to Satan for 7 years of fast living, high-tension liquor, and street-life babies, and for a juke joint brand of immortality, of course, which he had gotten, Robert Johnson, supposedly poisoned over a woman. In the late afternoon, I went down to the store and saw a good-looking piece of flounder in the cold case. It looked like supper to me. I bought a bottle of white wine to go with it, and while I was waiting my turn at the cash register, a trembling old man's voice spoke up behind me. "See, you made a new friend, Yesty." The Yankee accent was so thick that it sounded almost like a joke, except the accent itself is only part of it. Mostly, I've come to believe it's that sing-song tone. Real Mainers all sound like auctioneers. I turned and saw the geezer who had been standing out on the garage tarmac the day before, watching along with Dickie Brooks as I got to know Kyra, Maddie, and Scouty. He still had the gold-headed cane, and I now recognized it. Sometime in the 1950s, the Boston Post had donated one of those canes to every county in the New England states. They were given to the oldest residents and passed along from old fart to old fart. And the joke of it was that the post had gone toes up years ago. "Actually, two new friends," I replied, trying to dredge up his name. I couldn't do it, but I remembered him from when Joe had been alive, holding down one of the overstuffed chairs in Dickie's waiting room, discussing weather and politics, politics and weather, as the hammers whanged and the air compressor chugged. A regular. And if something happened out there on Highway 68, I God, he was there to see it. "I hear Matty DeVoe can be quite a dia," he said. "Hea, DeVoe, dia." and one of his crusty eyelids drooped. I have seen a fair number of salacious winks in my time, but none that was a patch on the one tipped me by that old man with the gold-headed cane. I felt a strong urge to knock his waxy beak of a nose off. The sound of it parting company from his face would be like the crack of a dead branch broken over a bent knee. "Do you hear a lot, old-timer?" I asked. "Oh, eya!" he said. His lips, dark as strips of liver, parted in a grin. His gums swarmed with white patches. He had a couple of yellow teeth still planted in the top one, and a couple more on the bottom. "And she got that little one. Cunning she is. Eya!" "Cunning as a cat a-running," I agreed. He blinked at me, a little surprised to hear such an old one out of my presumably newfangled mouth, and then that reprehensible grin widened. "Her don't mind her, though," he said. "Baby got the run of the place, don't you know?" I became aware, better belated than never, that half a dozen people were watching and listening to us. "That wasn't my impression," I said, raising my voice a bit. "No, that wasn't my impression at all." He only grinned, that old man's grin that says, "Oh, dear, I know one worth two of that." I left the store feeling worried for Mattie DeVore. Too many people were minding her business, it seemed to me. When I got home, I took my bottle of wine into the kitchen. It could chill while I got the barbecue going out on the deck. I reached for the fridge door, then paused. Perhaps as many as 4 dozen little magnets had been scattered randomly across the front. Vegetables, fruits, plastic letters and numbers, even a good selection of the California raisins. But they weren't random anymore. Now they formed a circle on the front of the refrigerator. Someone had been in here. Someone had come in and rearranged the magnets on the fridge? If so, that was a burglar who needed to do some heavy remedial work. I touched one of them, gingerly, with just the tip of my finger. Then, suddenly angry with myself, I reached out and spread them again, doing it with enough force to knock a couple to the floor. I didn't pick them up. That night, before going to bed, I placed the memo scriber on the table beneath Bunter the Great Stuffed Moose, turning it on and putting it in the dictate mode. Then I slipped in one of my old home-dubbed cassettes, zeroed the counter, and went to bed, where I slept without dreams or other interruption for 8 hours. The next morning, Monday, was the sort of day the tourists come to Maine for, the air so sunny clean that the hills across the lake seemed to be under subtle magnification. Mount Washington, New England's highest, floated in the furthest distance. I put on the coffee, then went into the living room, whistling. All my imaginings of the last few days seemed silly this morning. Then the whistle died away. The memo scriber's counter, set to 000 when I went to bed, was now at 012. I rewound it, hesitated with my finger over the play button, told myself, in Joe's voice, not to be a fool, and pushed it. "Oh, Mike," a voice whispered, mourned almost, on the tape, and I found myself having to press the heel of one hand to my mouth to hold back a scream. It was what I had heard in Joe's office when the draft rushed past the sides of my face, only now the words were slowed down just enough for me to understand them. "Oh, Mike," it said again. There was a faint click. The machine had shut down for some length of time. And then, once more, spoken in the living room as I had slept in the north wing, "Oh, my." Then it was gone. Around 9 o'clock, a pickup came down the driveway and parked behind my Chevrolet. The truck was new, a Dodge Ram so clean and chrome shiny it looked as if the 10-day plates had just come off that morning. but it was the same shade of off-white as the last one, and the sign on the driver's door was the one I remembered. William Bill Dean, camp checking, caretaking, light carpentry, plus his telephone number. I went out on the back stoop to meet him, coffee cup in my hand. "Mike!" Bill cried, climbing down from behind the wheel. Yankee men don't hug. That's a truism you can put right up there with tough guys don't dance and real men don't eat quiche. But Bill pumped my hand almost hard enough to slop coffee from a cup that was three-quarters empty and gave me a hearty clap on the back. His grin revealed a splendidly blatant set of false teeth, the kind which used to be called Roebuckers because you got them from the catalog. It occurred to me in passing that my ancient interlocutor from the Lakeview General Store could have used a pair. It certainly would have improved mealtimes for the nosy old fuck. "Mike, you're a sight for sore eyes." "Good to see you, too," I said, grinning. Nor was it a false grin. I felt all right. Things with the power to scare the living shit out of you on a thundery midnight in most cases seem only interesting in the bright light of a summer morning. "You're looking well, my friend." It was true. Bill was 4 years older and a little grayer around the edges, but otherwise the same. 65? 70? It didn't matter. There was no waxy look of ill health about him, and none of the falling away in the face, principally around the eyes and in the cheeks, that I associate with encroaching infirmity. "So are you," he said, letting go of my hand. "We was all so sorry about Joe, Mike. Folks in town thought the world of her. It was a shock with her so young. My wife asked if I'd give you her condolences special. Joe made her an Afghan the year she had the pneumonia, and a vet ain't never forgot it." "Thanks," I said, and my voice wasn't quite my own for a moment or two. It seemed that in the TR my wife was hardly dead at all. "And thank a vet, too." "Yeah. Everything okay with the house? Other than the air conditioner, I mean. Buggingly thing. Them at the Western Auto promised me that part last week, and now they're saying maybe not till August 1st. "It's okay. I've got my power book. If I want to use it, the kitchen table will do fine for a desk. And I would want to use it. So many crosswords, so little time. Got your hot water okay?" "All that's fine, but there is one problem." I stopped. "How did you tell your caretaker you thought your house was haunted?" Probably there was no good way. Probably the best thing to do was go at it head on. I had questions, but I didn't want to just nibble around the edges of the subject and be coy. For one thing, Bill would sense it. He might have bought his false teeth out of a catalog, but he wasn't stupid. "What's on your mind, Mike? Shoot." "I don't know how you're going to take this, but..." He smiled in the way of a man who suddenly understands and held up his hand. "Guess maybe I know already." "You do?" I felt an enormous sense of relief, and I could hardly wait to find out what he had experienced in Sarah, perhaps while checking for dead light bulbs or making sure the roof was holding the snow all right. "What did you hear?" "Mostly what Royce Merrill and Dickie Brooks have been telling," he said. "Beyond that, I don't know much. Me and Mother's been in Virginia, remember. Only got back last night around 8 o'clock. Still, it's the big topic down to the store." For a moment, I remained so fixed on Sarah's laughs that I had no idea what he was talking about. All I could think was that folks were gossiping about the strange noises in my house. Then the name Royce Merrill clicked, and everything else clicked with it. Merrill was the elderly possum with the gold-headed cane and the salacious wink, old foreteeth. My caretaker wasn't talking about ghostly noises. He was talking about Mattie DeVore. "Let's get you a cup of coffee," I said. "I need you to tell me what I'm stepping in here." When we were seated on the deck, me with fresh coffee and Bill with a cup of tea, "Coffee burns me at both ends these days," he'd said. I asked him first to tell me the Royce Merrill, Dickie Brooks version of my encounter with Mattie and Kyra. It turned out to be better than I had expected. Both old men had seen me standing at the side of the road with the little girl in my arms, and they had observed my Chevy parked halfway into the ditch with the driver's side door open, but apparently neither of them had seen Kyra using the white line of Route 68 as a tightrope. As if to compensate for this, however, Royce claimed that Maddie had given me a big My Hero hug and a kiss on the mouth. "Did he get the part about how I grabbed her by the ass and slipped her some tongue?" I asked. Bill grinned. "Royce's imagination ain't stretched that far since he was 50 or so, and that was 40 or more year ago." I never touched her. Well, there had been that moment when the back of my hand went sliding along the curve of her breast, but that had been inadvertent, whatever the young lady herself might think about it. "Shite, you don't need to tell me that," he said. "But..." He said that "but" the way my mother always had, letting it trail off on its own, like the tail of some ill-omened kite. "But what?" "You'd do well to keep your distance from her," he said. "She's nice enough, almost a town girl, don't you know, but she's trouble." He paused. "No, that ain't quite fair to her. She's in trouble." "The old man wants custody of the baby, doesn't he?" Bill set his teacup down on the deck rail and looked at me with his eyebrows raised. Reflections from the lake ran up his cheek in ripples, giving him an exotic look. "How'd you know?" "Guesswork, but of the educated variety. Her father-in-law called me Saturday night during the fireworks, and while he never came right out and stated his purpose, I doubt if Max DeVore came all the way back to TR-90 in western Maine to repo his daughter-in-law's Jeep and trailer. So what's the story, Bill?" For several moments, he only looked at me. It was almost the look of a man who knows you have contracted a serious disease and isn't sure how much he ought to tell you. Being looked at that way made me profoundly uneasy. It also made me feel that I might be putting Bill Dean on the spot. DeVore had roots here, after all, and as much as Bill might like me, I didn't. Joe and I were from away. It could have been worse. It could have been Massachusetts or New York. But Derry, although in Maine, was still away. "Bill, I could use a little navigational help if you..." "You want to stay out of his way," he said. His easy smile was gone. "The man's mad." For a moment, I thought Bill only meant DeVore was pissed off at me, and then I took another look at his face. No, I decided. He didn't mean pissed off. He had used the word mad in the most literal way. "Mad how?" I asked. "Mad like Charles Manson? Like Hannibal Lecter? How?" "Say, like Howard Hughes," he said. "Ever read any of the stories about him? The lengths he'd go to get the things he wanted? It didn't matter if it was a special kind of hot dog they only sold in L.A. or an airplane designer he wanted to steal from Lockheed or McDonnell Douglas. He had to have what he wanted, and he wouldn't rest until it was under his hand. DeVore is the same way. He always was. Even as a boy, he was willful, according to the stories you hear in town. My own dad had one he used to tell. He said little Max DeVore broke into Scant Larrabee's tack shed one winter because he wanted the flexible flyer Scant gave his boy Scooter for Christmas. Back around 1923, this would have been. DeVore cut both his hands on broken glass, Dad said, but he got the sled. They found him near midnight, sliding down Sugar Maple Hill, holding his hands up to his chest when he went down. He'd bled all over his mittens and his snowsuit. There's other stories you'll hear about Maxie DeVore as a kid. If you ask, you'll hear 50 different ones, and some may even be true. The one about the sled is true, though. I'd bet the farm on it, because my father didn't lie. It was against his religion. Baptist? No, sir. Yankee. 1923 was many moons ago, Bill. Sometimes people change. But mostly they don't. I haven't seen DeVore since he come back and moved into Warrington, so I can't say for sure, but I've heard things that make me think that if he has changed, it's for the worse. He didn't come all the way across the country because he wanted a vacation. He wants the kid. To him, she's just another version of Scooter Larrabee's flexible flyer. And my strong advice to you is that you don't want to be the window glass between him and her. I sipped my coffee and looked out at the lake. Bill gave me time to think, scraping one of his work boots across a splatter of bird shit on the boards while I did it. Crow shit, I reckoned. Only crows crap in such long and exuberant splatters. One thing seemed absolutely sure. Maddie DeVore was roughly 9 miles up Shit Creek with no paddle. I'm not the cynic I was at 20, is anyone? But I wasn't naive enough or idealistic enough to believe the law would protect Ms. Doublewide against Mr. Computer, not if Mr. Computer decided to play dirty. As a boy, he'd taken the sled he wanted and gone sliding by himself at midnight, bleeding hands not a concern. And as a man, an old man who had been getting every sled he wanted for the last 40 years or so? What's the story with Maddie, Bill? Tell me. It didn't take him long. Country stories are, by and large, simple stories, which isn't to say they're not often interesting. Maddie DeVore had started life as Maddie Stanchfield, not quite from the TR, but just over the line in Monton. Her father had been a logger, her mother a home beautician, which made it, in a ghastly way, the perfect country marriage. There were 4 kids. When Dave Stanchfield missed a curve over in Lovell and drove a fully loaded pulp truck into Key Waden Pond, his widow kind of lost heart, as they say. There had been no insurance other than what Stanchfield had been obliged to carry on his Jimmy and his skidder. Talk about your brothers Grimm, huh? Subtract the Fisher-Price toys behind the house, the 2 pole hair dryers in the basement beauty salon, the old rust-bucket Toyota in the driveway, and you were right there. Once upon a time there lived a poor widow and her 4 children. Maddie is the princess of the piece. Poor but beautiful. That she was beautiful, I could personally testify. Now enter the prince. In this case, he's a gangly, stuttering redhead named Lance DeVore, the child of Max DeVore's sunset years. When Lance met Maddie, he was 21. She had just turned 17. The meeting took place at Warrington's, where Maddie had landed a summer job as a waitress. Lance DeVore was staying across the lake on the Upper Bay, but on Tuesday nights there were pickup softball games at Warrington's, the townies against the summer folks, and he usually canoed across to play. Softball is a great thing for the Lance DeVores of the world. When you're standing at the plate with a bat in your hands, it doesn't matter if you're gangly, and it sure doesn't matter if you stutter. He confused them quite considerable over to Warrington's, Bill said. They didn't know which team he belonged on, the locals or the aways. Lance didn't care. Either side was fine with him. Some weeks he'd play for one, some weeks t'other. Either one was more than happy to have him, too, as he could hit a ton and feel like an angel. They'd put him at first base a lot because he was tall, but he was really wasted there. At second or shortstop, my, he'd jump and twirl around like that guy Noriega. You might mean Nureyev, I said. He shrugged. Point is, he was something to see. And folks liked him. He fit in. It's mostly young folks that play, you know, and to them it's how you do, not who you are. Besides, a lot of them don't know Max DeVore from a hole in the ground. Unless they read the Wall Street Journal and the computer magazines, I said. In those, you run across the name DeVore about as often as you run across the name of God in the Bible. No fooling. Well, I guess that in the computer magazines, God is more often spelled Gates, but you know what I mean. I suppose. But even so, it's been 65 years since Max DeVore spent any real time in the T.I. You know what happened when he left, don't you? No. Why would I? He looked at me, surprised. Then a kind of veil seemed to fall over his eyes. He blinked, and it cleared. Tell you another time. It ain't no secret, but I need to be over to the Harrimans by 11 to check their sump pump. Don't want to get sidetracked. Point I was trying to make is just this. Lance DeVore was accepted as a nice young fella who could hit a softball 350 feet into the trees if he struck it just right. There was no one old enough to hold his old man against him. Not at Warrington's on Tuesday nights, there wasn't. And no one held it against him that his family had dough, either. Hell, a lot of wealthy people here in the summer. You know that. None worth as much as Max DeVore, but being rich is only a matter of degree. That wasn't true, and I had just enough money to know it. Wealth is like the Richter scale. Once you pass a certain point, the jumps from one level to the next aren't double or triple, but some amazing and ruinous multiple you don't even want to think about. Hemingway had it straight, although I guess he didn't believe his own insight. The rich are different from you and me. I thought of telling Bill that and decided to keep my mouth shut. He had a sump pump to fix.